We're going to pick up with chapter 20 tonight, and as we've mentioned, I'll just keep a real summary as we start. The whole book of Job is about human suffering, and as we've talked, suffering often comes from other people's sin, from our sin, or from time and chance. And we're going to see, we know, of course, a lot more behind the scenes as the curtain is unveiled for us. We know what's going on between Satan and God. And but Job doesn't know that, and so he's going through a lot of questioning of why things are happening to him. And so again, we're at the second cycle of discussions, and so tonight we're going to do chapter 20, 21, and that'll wrap up the second cycle, and then we'll be starting the next Wednesday on the third and final cycle of discussions. After we go through the third cycle, there is a interlude in praise of wisdom, and then Job then sums up his past, his present, and his future. And then we have a young man by the name of Elihu who seems to interrupt. He's been listening to all the older men because they were privileged to speak first, and he's waited his turn. And so Elihu then comes in, interrupts, and gives his two cents to the whole situation. And then finally we wrap up with God coming out of the whirlwind and questioning Job. And so very, very exciting end to the book. And so we are making very good progress. We're going to go and start in chapter 20. And chapter 20 is Zophar, and he is the third of the friends. And I'm going to ask, I've talked to BJ and Kevin if they'd do some reading for me. So this chapter is 29 verses long. So BJ, can I have you read 1 through 19? That kind of completes the thought there. And then Kevin, if you can read 20 through 29 through the end of it. Okay, thank you.
Then Zophar, therefore my thoughts answer me, because of my haste within me. I hear censor that insults me, and out of my understanding a spirit answers me. Do you know, or do you not know this from old, since man was placed on the earth, that the exulting of the wicked is short, and the joy of the godless but for a moment? Though his height mount up to the heavens, and his head reach to the clouds, he will perish forever like his own dung. Those who have seen him will say, where is he? He will fly away like a dream and not be found. He will be chased away like a vision of the night. The eye that saw him will see him no more, nor will his place any more behold him. His children will seek the favor of the poor, and his hands will give back his wealth. His bones are full of his youthful vigor, but it will lie down with him in the dust. Though evil is sweet in his mouth, and though he hides it under his tongue, and though he is loath to let it go, and he holds it in his mouth, yet his food is turned in his stomach, and it is venom of the cobras within him. He swallows down riches and vomits them up again. God casts them out of his belly. He will suck the poison of cobras. The tongue of a viper will kill him. He will not look upon the rivers, the streams flowing with honey and curds. He will give back the fruit of his toil and will not swallow it down. From the profit of his trading he will get no enjoyment, for he has crashed and abandoned the poor. He has seized a house that he did not build.
Because he knew no contentment in his belly, he will not let anything in which he delights escape him. There was nothing left after he had eaten, therefore his prosperity will not endure. In the fullness of his sufficiency he will be in distress. The hand of everyone in misery will come against him. To fill his belly to the full, God will send his burning anger from an iron weapon, a bronze arrow will strike him through. It is drawn forth and comes out of his body. The glittering point comes out of his gallbladder. Terrors come upon him. Utter darkness is laid up for his treasures. A fire not fanned will devour him. What is left in his tent will be consumed. The heavens will reveal his iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him. The possessions of his house will be carried away, dragged off in the day of God's wrath. This is the wicked man's portion from God.
Okay, thank you, BJ. Thank you, Kevin. All right, we're going to see here with Zophar as we kick off here in verse 20 that he's a little incensed. You might remember from the end of last week that Job's parting shot at the end of chapter 19, verse 29 was that you three need to remember there's going to be a judgment for you as well. And Zophar seems to be a little incensed about that. with Job's concluding words, and because of Job's insinuation that the three friends and not Job were guilty and stood in danger of God's judgment. And this arouses within him a very quick and a very indignant response. So he's a little incensed at the final remarks he just heard earlier in chapter 19. In verse 3, he talks about the fact that I have heard the reproof that reproaches me, and the spirit of my understanding causes me to answer. Job's words were a reproach, intended to bring shame and dishonor, not only upon the three men, but also it was a reproach on their wisdom. You're going to see them keep going back to their wisdom and their theology. It's something they stand upon and hold fast their position on. In verses 4 and 5, it's rather interesting. Zophar goes through some posed questions here, and they're really based more on traditional thinking or philosophy rather than fact. And that's something, you know, we as Christians today have to be careful of too, is posing our thinking around tradition or traditional ways of doing things and not on what the scriptures actually teach. But one of the things he points out is that the triumph of the wicked is short-lived, according to Zophar. And also the joy of the godless, it just lasts for a moment. It's just like a passing second. And he's, again, wrapping all this into a generalized bucket. In verses 6 and 7, he talks about the wicked and their aspirations. He says in verse 7, yet he will perish like his own. The word he uses is dung or refuse. The wicked through his aspirations, he reaches for the skies, he reaches for the heavens, and through his head, he reaches through the clouds, but according to Zophar, he's going to perish just like his own dung. BJ.
Well, I think Zophar seems to be speaking out of self-defense at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I might be wrong in my understanding of how he's thinking, but what he's combating as I read this and as I read this earlier was, you know, Job had talked about that the righteous sometimes do suffer and that the evil sometimes do prosper. But if he continues with his way of thinking, Zophar that is, that would mean and imply that Zophar himself could be a sinful man. But the fact that he has not been short-lived in his prosperity and the fact that he has long dwelt in comfort, in his mind is his righteousness. Mm-hmm. That's a confirmation of his righteousness. So the reason that Job's words insult him is because it could imply that Zophar could be a sinful man. And he doesn't like that thought. And so that's why he's now changed his tone, and now he's more speaking out of self-defense to make himself look good.
Absolutely. And you've probably seen this as we've gone along, the tone of these conversations or debates with Job get more intense each cycle. Because all three of his friends, you know, become incensed. At first, they're kind of playing the statesman, and we're here to help you, Job, and get your life straightened out. But then, as it continues to go on, they pretty much get incensed, and it's an attack on their theology, and possibly attack on them and their views. And so, and I appreciate the comments, BJ. Thank you very much. In verse 8. Zophar continues his thought that the wicked man, he will fly away like a dream and he will not be found. Just like a dream or vision, the wicked man, he's going to be chased into oblivion. God's not going to let him be successful. He's going to get chased away into oblivion. In verse number 9, he talks about just as the eye of the subconscious saw the dream go away, so shall the physical eye behold the wicked man no more. So the wicked man's not going to achieve the things he wants within his own thoughts and within his own mind. But not only that, he's not going to achieve things physically. You're not going to see him anymore because he's going to be gone. He's going to be removed from the earth. As he said earlier, he's going to perish like his own dung. So very, very kind of scorching remarks here. And then in verse 10, he talks about the fact that not only does the wicked man fall from exaltation, wealth, and pride, but so also does his family. And again, this I think is a jab at Job's family, because remember, his children are all dead, and his wife has told him to curse God and die. And so he kind of pokes at him here and says, you know, the wicked man, his children, are going to have to seek favor from the poor. and his hands, the wicked man's hands, he's going to give everything back. So there's an insinuation here that Job has taken things illegally. He has taken things by deceit. He has taken things by reproach. He has taken things, and we'll get in, he points out some specific sins here and just a few verses. But he basically accuses Job of being a bad person and taking from the fatherless, the orphans, and the widows. And he says, a wicked man, he's not going to keep anything. He's going to give everything back. It's going to be given back from his own hand. In verse 11, some of the commentators struggle a little bit with this one, but I think the best that I read on this, he talks about the fact that the wicked man's youthful vigor, his bones are full of youthful vigor, but he will lie down with him in the dust. The wicked is going to basically, it's saying he's going to die at a younger age. The youthful vigor will be in his bones. Sometimes that is an expression about the bone marrow is still wet in his bones. He's not like an old man with osteoporosis or something like that. He's going to die and come to an early end. And so that seems to be what the most commentaries think he's talking about, is that Job, you're a wicked man. You're not going to live to be an old age. You're going to die young, and you're going to give everything back because you've taken it from others. Verses 12 through 15, Zophar kind of pictures here, and he's thinking of Job when he says this, but he pictures the wicked as savoring his wickedness. And he refers to comments like the wicked man savors his wickedness like a sweet morsel of food that's under the tongue. And so, you know, when you or I have eaten a dish, maybe it's a really good dessert or it's a really good steak. It's just, you just love savoring that flavor. And you savor that under the tongue. And he's saying this is what the wicked man does. He savors this wickedness and his achievements just like a morsel under the tongue. And then yet at the same time, he will, instead of savoring that, he's going to have the venom of cobras in his stomach. And because of that, everything is going to get vomited up. It's going to get returned. He's not going to keep the things that he has taken from others. So it's just like he's been poisoned with cobra's venom. He's going to be real sick, and he's going to give everything up, and he's going to die. He makes another analogy in verse number 16. He says, he will suck the poison of cobras, and the viper's tongue will slay him. Just like a baby that nurses on his mother's breast, the wicked man nurses upon wickedness. And this is what is going to be poisoning his well-being. And basically what he's saying, if we put it in modern-day vernacular, is the poison of wickedness is going to slay him. So, you know, really, really serious charges here. And then we're going to get into some actual things where he points the finger and starts assuming, making some assumptions of what Job has done as far as his wickedness. And so we'll flip over then to the next page here. We'll get into verses 17 and 18. And right here is the consequences of the wicked man's folly is listed here. He says, he will not see the streams and the rivers flowing with honey and cream. He will restore that for which he labored and will not swallow it down from the proceeds of his business. He will get no enjoyment. So again, this metaphor he's describing that Job apparently has taken things illegally from people and he's not going to be allowed to keep it. He has robbed others. And so this is the wicked man's folly. He's not going to be permitted to look upon the beautiful land. Furthermore, his labor of dishonest gain will be restored and will not be retained. He will not keep the things that he has. And so remember, Job's lost everything, and so this fits right in with the Zophar's philosophy. Job has been bitten by the cobra, and Job has vomited up everything. Job has given up everything. Now, he gets into some specifics here, beginning in verse 19, and these are, again, a finger pointing at Job. He talks about how the wicked man oppressed the poor. In verse 19, he says, "For he has oppressed and forsaken the poor, and he has violently seized a house which he did not build." That's a direct accusation and insinuation to Job. That Job, how you got your wealth is you took homes from others. You have oppressed and forsaken the poor, and you've taken their homes from them. well, the word oppress literally translates as to crush or to break into pieces. And the word forsake means to leave or depart from or abandon. And what Zophar is saying here is that Job has oppressed or broken in pieces the poor. And the poor are basically left to wander about without any shelter. Per Zophar, the Job cared nothing for the poor because he had robbed them and he had thrown them out of their own home. So a very serious accusation here. Bruce, I see you getting ready to ask a question.
This is the first verse that I see where Job can actually point to and say, I know why I stand where I stand. I have not sinned because I have not done this.
Right.
And so, you know, all along we wonder how Job can be so adamant about, I have not sinned against God, yet this is the first time he can say,
I didn't do that.
I've never done that.
Yeah. This is one of the first times that the three friends start getting specifics.
No, but they've been generalized.
Generalized, right.
This is specific. And he can go back and say, show me one instance.
Yeah. Earlier, they've been poking at things. Well, maybe you did this, maybe you did that, maybe you did. This is one of the first times that a direct accusation has been, you know, leveled at Job. And you're right. This is something Job can say, no, I haven't done that. And so Zophar really starts picking at some specifics now as we continue here in chapter 20. So very good point. And that is one of the first times we see a specific mention here. He continues on in verse 20. He says, because he knows no quietness in his heart, he will not save anything that he desires. And basically, the wicked and the greedy man, he doesn't know any contentment. He's not content with what he has or quietness. He desires the material. He desires the physical. And both of these are temporary and both of these are transitory. And in verse 21, he's basically referring to the fact that by living for the here and the now, men will consume his resources and his prosperity, as a wicked man is not going to endure. And he literally is living in a fool's paradise, is basically what that verse 21 translates out to. There's a couple of expressions that he uses in verse 22. He says, in his self-sufficiency, he will be in distress, and every hand of misery will come against him. Some translations have the word straits. Fullness of sufficiency literally translates the peak of plenty. And straits means very intense internal turmoil. Just a little language here for you to understand what he's saying here in verse 22. But every hand of misery will come against him. Intense internal turmoil. And so he's continuing his condemnation of Job. In verse 23, he talks about his belly. He says, when he's about to fill his stomach, God will cast on him the fury of his wrath, and it will rain on him while he is eating. And so the belly here really is, in the time that Job lived, really referred to the seat of one's desires. And so basically what he's saying here is God is going to rain his wrath upon him and cast upon him the fury of his wrath as he's trying to fill up his belly or his desires with these things. God is going to rain wrath down upon him. So again, this is all being alluded to Job. Another thing he refers to Job is the fact that wicked people just will not be able to escape the consequences of sin. And that's really what he's saying in verse 24. He says, he will flee from the iron weapon, and a bronze bow will pierce him through. It is drawn and comes out of the body. Yes, the glittering point comes out of his gall. Terrors are upon him. The idea here is that the wicked man is going to be felled by an opponent. That's going to be Job. And he just will not be able to escape the consequences of sin. Kind of very similar, if you remember, in the book of Acts, when Paul, and as they're shipwrecked on the island, and he goes to get some wood to put on the fire, and remember a serpent comes out, and bites them, and they say, wow, this guy must be really a bad person, because even though he escaped the sea, the gods would not let it come to pass that he could escape, and so now the serpent has bit him. So he's not going to escape the consequences of sin. And of course, when Paul didn't die, they thought then he was a god or something. So, but that's what the same idea is, that Job, you're not going to escape the consequences of your sin. You're going to be felled by an opponent, and you just will not escape because of all this wickedness that you have achieved in your life. In verse 25, again, that reference to he's being shot like with an arrow or a bow, and it says the wicked man is shut down. The terrors of death are upon him, and the arrow will pierce him through. Verse 26, total darkness is reserved for his treasures, and unfanned fire will consume him. It will go ill with him who is left in his tent. And the reference here is possibly the fire of God. A lot of commentators kind of kick this one back and forth. But the idea basically is that God's wrath is going to consume all that are left. And this is going to be God's fury or the fire of God. BJ, you look like you're going to comment something.
Some of what Zophar says is it's true. The fact is that it's just misplaced because it's directed towards Job. I just think it's really interesting, verse 24, going back to that he'll flee from an iron weapon, but a bronze arrow will strike him through. That's exactly how Saul dies.
Right.
Is by trying to flee from battle, and yet a stray arrow ends up hitting him before he ends up, taking his own life or asking his arm bearer to do it. But I just think it's really interesting some of the things that Zophar says. We actually see a literal, interpretation of that actually coming true later on in Scripture. So not all of what he says is incorrect.
That's true.
But it's just misdirected because it's towards Job, and it's put in the vernacular this mentality that he's approaching it with.
So. Right. And that's a very good point. Wayne brought that up, I think, last week, that when we get done with all this, it would be nice to go back and look at a lot of these generalities are true about wicked people, but a lot of this is misplaced because it's directed towards Job. But again, the insinuation here is Job has done a lot of very, very bad things in his life, and that's how he got his wealth. Now, in verse 27, you might recall, it says that here in the Scripture, it says the heavens will reveal his iniquity and the earth will rise up against him. You might remember earlier that back in chapter 16, Job had requested that the earth would not cover up his blood, and that the heavens, that there would be a witness in the heavens that would vouch for him that he truly is an innocent person. And basically in verse 27, what Zophar is insinuating to Job is that instead heaven would witness his iniquity. In other words, Job, instead of a witness to vouch for you, you're going to have a witness that vouches for your sins and your sinful condition. So he's not really letting up any on Job at all. Verse 28 says, the increase of his house will depart, his goods will flow away in the day of his wrath. Job's goods would depart or be in exile. His goods will flow away, almost like being in a flood. In general, Zophar says about the wicked, BG was just saying this, in generality, the things he says about the wicked is true, but it doesn't apply to Job. And there's not one single flicker of love, mercy, or compassion shown by Zophar here. It's pretty serious, and basically, Job, you've done these things, and you're an evil person. And so this is one of the first times that some direct accusations have been leveled at Job. And that's chapter 20. Bruce.
I was going to say, by his reply, it shows that Zophar and these other guys are really paying attention to Job's commentary, because they're going back and item by item trying to account for their stand on it. So it shows that they just wasn't sitting there waiting for him to get done talking.
No.
They were attentive to what he was saying.
And I haven't even brought up a lot more of what you just said. There's a whole bunch more that is direct references to chapter 4 or chapter 5 or chapter 6. I'm just pointing out some of the major ones. But yes, they are very intent about responding to every one of Job's points to prove their point and to say that he's in the wrong. And it's very fascinating because I think you're exactly right. They were intently listening to what he was saying. And you have to put yourself in their shoes. These are the wise men of their day. These are not dumb people. These are very, very wise individuals. They were recognized in their time and in their society as the wise of society. And I think they truly cared about Job. But when it came down to showing compassion versus giving up their theology, that's where all stops. You know, everything stops. And so Job has listened to all of this, and now it's his turn to respond. And he gives his discourse on the wicked as well, but he points out that no, there's a whole lot of things that the wicked do that they never get caught at. And sometimes the wicked live a long and prosperous life. And so he's going to start breaking this theology down that they keep going back to. So, Wayne.
I don't think you mean theology. I think you mean philosophy.
Philosophy, yes. It was their theology, but it was their philosophy. It really was. That's what they thought was right. So, yeah, that's a very good point. All right, let's read chapter 21. If I could get another reader or two. Anybody else like to do this? Okay, Marv, could I get you to read verses 1 through 16? And then if I can get someone else to read 17 through 34. Anybody else want to read that? Bruce? Okay, 17 through 34. Okay, Marv, chapter 21, 1 through 16.
Then Job answered, "Listen carefully to my speech, and let this be your way of consolation. Bear with me that I may speak. Then after I have spoken, you may mock. As for me, my complaint is to man, and why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be astonished. Put your hand over your mouth. Even when I remember, I am disturbed. The horror takes hold of my flesh. Why do the wicked still live? Continue on. Also become very powerful. Their descendants are established within their sight, and their offspring are before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, and the rod of God is not on them. His ox mates without fail. His cow calf does not absorb corn. They send forth little ones like the flock, and their children skip about. They sing to the tambourine and the harp, and rejoice in the sound of the flute. They spend their days in prosperity and suddenly go down to Shum. They say to God, depart from us. We don't even desire the knowledge of your ways. Who is the Almighty that we may serve him? And what would we gain if we retreat him? Behold, the prosperity is not in their hands. The counsel of the wicked is far from me."
How often is the lamp of the wicked put out? Or does their calamity fall on them? Does God apportion destruction in his anger? Are they as straw before the wind, and like chaff which is the storm carries away? You say, God stores away a man's iniquity for his sins. Let God repay him so that he may know it. Let his own eyes see his decay, and let him drink of the wrath of the Almighty. For what does he care for his household after him, when the number of his months is cut off? Can anyone teach God knowledge, in that his judges those on high? He dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and satisfied. His sides are filled out with fat, and the marrow of his bones is moist. While another dies with him bitter soul, never even tasting anything good. Together they lie down in the dust, and worms cover them. Behold, I know your thoughts and the plans by which you would wrong me. For you say, where is the house of the nobleman? And where is the tent and the dwelling places of the wicked? Have you not asked wayfaring men, and do you not recognize their witness? For the wicked is reserved for the day of calamity. They will lead forth at the day of the fury. Who will confront him with his actions, and who will repay him for what he has done? While he is carried to the grave, men will keep watch over his tomb. The clods of the valley will gently cover him. Moreover, all men will fall after him, while countless ones go before him. How then will you vainly comfort me, for your answers remain full of falsehood?
Thank you, Bruce, and thank you, Marv. Okay, Job is going to give his discourse on the wicked, And the big difference here is Job is going to give Zophar a reality check. Zophar is trying to make everybody fit into the square peg, into the square hole. And what Job says is, no, it's not always like that. The wicked aren't always cut off. The wicked don't always die young. The wicked sometimes prosper, and their family prospers, and their children prospers, and their herds prosper, and they live to be a long age. And then Job goes on later, though, and says, but sometimes that doesn't happen. And the great equalizer for everybody, for the rich man, the poor man, the righteous man, the sinful man, is death. And that's what he gets into in verses 20 through 22 through 26. But let's start at the top here. Job has his discourse now on the wicked. Job's friends have constantly fallen back on their traditional views, as Wayne said, their philosophy that all suffering was punishment for wrongdoing. And so Job says in verses 1 and 2 that he's going to offer them some words of truth, and their consolation to him would be just to listen and learn from him. In other words, he says, I'm going to give you some real examples, some real life examples. They keep going back to their traditional views. He goes, no, let's talk reality. And that's really what he's saying here. In verse 3, basically Job is stating, let me speak. And then if you want, you can continue to mock me. He's said that a couple times now. But he says, give me an opportunity to respond. I'm going to tell you how things really are in the real world. And in verse 4, I think it's important to point out that he says that, as for me, is my complaint against man? And the answer is no. If it were, why should I not be impatient? Job is basically saying that his complaint is not to them or to man, but rather his complaint is to God himself. Job's complaint is in addressing God. Verse 5, he uses some language. He says, look at me and be astonished. That literally translates be stunned. When he uses the expression, and it depends on the translation you have, he says, mark me. That means face me. He wants them to look at him and to be astonished. And he uses the expression, lay your hand. That means to be silent. He wants them to look at him, to face him, and to be silent, because he wants to address them. And then in verse 6, he talks about the fact that he says, when I remember, I am terrified. The word remember there, he's basically saying he wants them to think about or meditate. Job wants them to realize that the lot of the wicked doesn't always fit their square peg in a square hole. It isn't always the way that his friends have described. That doesn't always happen. In verse 7, he starts down his analogy of some things that do happen with the wicked. And in verse 7 is where he starts some of this. He says, the wicked sometimes live to an old age. Okay? They don't always die young. And sometimes the wicked will stay mighty in power until they die at an old age. They don't always meet the early demise. And so that directly flies in the face of their philosophy, their theology. He goes on, though, when he starts down this diatribe. In verse 8, he says, the wicked sometimes see their posterity established. Verse 9, the wicked sometimes have homes that are safe, and they're safe from any fear. And what the point that Job's trying to make here, and I've got it in your notes, in your handout there, is Job is stating that sometimes the same blessings that the righteous man enjoys are also bestowed and happen to the wicked man. And that's what he's trying to get them to realize. He continues on with his train of thought. Verse 10. He says, sometimes even the wicked man's cattle and the wicked man's flocks prosper. Instead of having the cattle miscarry and having them not able to breed, he says, sometimes the wicked man's cattle are very prosperous and the flocks are prospering. Verse 11. The wicked sometimes are prospered with many happy and healthy and children, and he talks about them dancing about singing. In verse 12, the wicked sometimes have prosperity and they sing and they rejoice. Verse 13, the wicked sometimes live out all of their days in the comfort of their wealth. They don't suffer long, lingering illnesses before their death but rather they're snatched up by Sheol quickly. And we can all certainly identify with someone we've known in our life that had a lingering, long, enduring death. It's very painful to see, very painful to watch. And Job says, sometimes the wicked have a very quick death. They live to be a long age, and their cattle prosper, their children prosper, they sing, they rejoice, they live out their days and their wealth. They don't have any long, lingering illness, and they die a very quick death. So it just doesn't follow the mold that his friends have been preaching at him. And furthermore, he says in verse 14, they insult God. The wicked men that Job were familiar with, they basically say to God, depart from us, verse 14. They reject the ways of holiness. They reject the ways of righteousness required by God. And they basically, with their wealth, they conclude they have no need for God. Do we see that in our society? You betcha. We have a whole lot of wealthy people in our country that think they have no need for God. They have their money, and they have their wealth, and they have the things that they want in this life. Why would they need God? And so that's what his thought is that the wicked, he's observed, have no need for God. Clinton. Exactly. He was Pharaoh. He was...
He's pretty rich.
That's right. He was very rich. And that's unfortunately a pride problem when people get to where they don't feel they have all they need in this life. They feel like they don't need God. And the point that Job is trying to make here, if you look down at verse 16, is that ultimately, though, the wicked's prosperity, even though they think it is, it's not in their own hand, but it's ultimately everything is under God's control. God determines the destiny of all. And that's what he's saying down in verse 16. He says, indeed, their prosperity is not in their hand. The counsel of the wicked is far from me. What he's saying is that even though they think it's under their control, it is not. Everything really is under the control of God, as we know it. In verses 17 and 18, Job doesn't deny that there may be cases in which these things befall a wicked man, but he denies that his friend's statements basically has a universal application. God is impartial and gives both to the godly man and to the ungodly man alike. You might remember what Jesus said in Matthew 5:45, the rain falls on the just and the unjust. And so that is exactly what Job is saying here, is that, yes, there is universal application that in general, good things befall people that fear God and bad things befall those that don't, but it doesn't always fit. And God gives impartially to both the good and the bad man. And so that's what he's trying to get his friends to understand, is there are exceptions to this universal rule. Verses 19 and 20, he seems to be addressing the fact that the consequences for sin is involved here. And again, there's a reminder that God does not visit the punishment of the father's sins upon the son. And the verse I put up there for you to refer to is Ezekiel 18. Is the son will not suffer from the father's sins. Now, the son may suffer from the consequences of the father's sins. And we see that in our society every day, people will suffer from the consequences of other people's sin. They don't suffer from their sin, but they suffer from consequences. And that's something that we have to deal with in our life. A man who is a family man, I'll just make up something, he becomes a drunk and he gets in trouble, robs a bank, and he goes to prison. Well, his wife and his children now are going to suffer because of his consequences. His sin is his, but they will suffer the consequences. And so that's really what Job is trying to point out here in verses 19 and 20. In verse 21, he says the wicked are selfish. They live for the present. They do not look beyond the end of their own days. And that's what he's saying here in verse 21. He says, for what does he care about his household after him? In other words, he's living for himself. And he says, when the number of his months is cut in half. In other words, he doesn't care. He's living for himself. He's living for the day. In verse 22, there's an interesting question here. He asks, who can cause God to know something? either through the senses or by experience? And of course, the answer is no one. God is infinite, God is sovereign, and God is absolute in knowledge. And then that kind of sets up this next few verses that he starts talking about the great equalizer. And the great equalizer, as we all know, is death. Whether you're a king or whether you're a poor man, whether you're an intelligent man or a man with no education, the great equalizer that we all face in this life is death. Death is the great equalizer. And that's what he starts talking about here. He starts making some comparisons. Verse 23, he says, "One dies in full strength, being wholly at ease and secure." So in verse 24, "His pails are full of milk, and the marrow of his bones is moist." So here we have one who dies in prosperity. He has pails of milk. His bone marrow is moist. He's been a well-fed individual. He's healthy. And then he talks in verses 25 and 26. The comparison to that is another dies in adversity. This is the person in verses 25 and 26 who dies in bitterness of soul. This is the one who never gets to experience the good things in this life. And the point that Job is making here is that they both, the prosperous person and the person who has been in adversity, they both come to the same end. In death, both return to the dust. In death, both become food for worms, because death is the great equalizer. And then as we draw towards the end of the chapter here, verse 27, he says, "Look, I know your thoughts and the schemes with which you would wrong me." So he's basically saying he knows their threat, the three friends, he knows their intent and their purposes. They're trying to lay some kind of guilt upon him. And in verse 28, he asks the question, he says, "When they say, 'Where is the prince?' they're mocking Job." And the point being, Job isn't the prince of his family anymore. He isn't the prince of his own household. And so it's kind of a mocking statement when they asked him earlier, where's the prince? Because Job had everything removed. His children are dead. All his possessions are gone. And the point is, Job has fallen. Job has been destroyed. And Job has come to nothing. And so he says, "I know your thoughts. Your intent is to try to lay some guilt upon me. And that's why you say, 'Hey, where is the prince?' Because the prince has fallen." He goes into a little bit of a sidebar in verses 29 and 30. He says, "Have you not asked those that travel the road? And do you not know their signs? For the wicked are reserved for the day of doom." He seems to be, and again, did you have a question, Bruce, before we go on? Oh, I'm sorry. Please remind me. Yes. There you go. He seems to be referring to wayfaring men here. Several of the commentaries kind of struggle with these two verses. But the thought seems to be that he's turning his thoughts to travelers in their time. This is a patriarchal age, and a lot of people traveled about. And he seems to be talking about wayfaring men that travel the highways and the byways and the roads. They are men who move about a lot in their life. And the thought seems to be that these men that travel a lot, they can either be good or they can also be bad. And one just doesn't know, but they are men who travel about in that day and that time. And so then he asks the questions, "Who will testify to Job's face the evil way of his life?" His point in verse 31 is, none of you can lay something on me. He says, "Who condemns his way to the face? Who repays him for what he has done?" His point is, you guys can't level anything against me. I have done nothing wrong. No one can level something on me. Verse 32, he goes into another diatribe about the rich man. And basically what he says here, he says the rich man is a man who's often feared in this life. Oftentimes rich men have a lot of power. And in death, they're carried to the grave with a lot of pomp and circumstance, with a lot of great honor and a lot of great splendor. You might remember Luke 16, the rich man versus Lazarus. Okay, the rich man was buried with a lot of pomp and circumstance. He wakes up and he's in Hades. Lazarus falls by the wayside dead. and he is taken up by angels. And so he's pointing out that rich men are often feared. They're often men of power. They're buried with pomp and circumstance. And even men, the reference in verse 32 seems to be that men will even watch over their tomb to make sure it's not vandalized. This was something that if you follow a lot of things in the Egyptians and the pyramids, there were a lot of many years there they had people watching for tomb raiders, because they would raid the tombs of the pharaohs, and they had a lot of people that would watch after that the tombs weren't vandalized. In verse 33, in death, the wicked man finds kinship, and he uses the expression with clods of the earth as he returns back to dust. Our bodies are going to return to what it came from, to dust. And he says, all men will draw after him. It seems to be a reference to a funeral procession for the wealthy man. Final point, final shot across the bow to Zophar. In verse 34, Job says he finds no comfort in his three friends. They misrepresent God. Their answers are false accusations based on traditional error. They refuse to consider the evidence of human experience. And that's what Job's been trying to show them, is take a look at reality. Sometimes the rich prosper. And that's what he's been trying to get them to do in this this whole chapter. And so the final point for chapter 21 is that the wicked can indeed end their lives in prosperity or in poverty. The rain falls on the just and the unjust. And that's what Job is trying to get them to understand, a basic fact of life. It isn't always the square peg in the square hole. Heather. Exactly. And the part that we, and very, very good point, we take comfort is it may not be made right in this life. We all know that. You know, it's, things may continue for the wicked person and he'll live out his life. And things may happen bad to the good person and they'll live out their life. All things will be made right, though, on the eternal side. And that's when we have God, the great vindicator, and will stand in our behalf with Jesus. So that's something we can take comfort in. It's not, life is not fair. And that's something that we all have to realize. Bad things happen to good people. And some bad things happen to Job. But in the hereafter, everything will be made right. And that's something that we can take comfort in. Over here. I guess if he had sinned, he probably, knowing the character of Job, he would have admitted to it.
But if you approach somebody nowadays that way, they would, you'd turn them off completely.
Yeah, that's true. Clinton.
Job said earlier, miserable comforters you are. So they weren't doing him no good by the time he started chewing on him.
Well, part of what also gets them in trouble, not only were not good comforters, they start misrepresenting God. And when we get to the end of the book of Job, God takes them into account and says, you go ask my righteous servant Job to make offerings for you, because they misrepresented God. And so we're going to say things come into a good balance at the end of the story, but at the end of the account. But very fascinating. Bruce?
I was just going to say, Job, in his heyday, was a very powerful man and controlled everything. And that type of person would have had a standing protocol that all of his people would follow. Mm-hmm. If you see a visitor, you bring him in. You know, if you see somebody in need, you do. So he's coming from this place of, I did everything right, and that's the only reason. Because I struggled many times of how could Job be so
almost arrogant?
Yeah. About his righteousness with mm-hmm. God. And it's only because by the rules that he was living by at that time, he could say, no, I've got a checklist and I followed it.
Yeah. And he never says he was totally sinless, but he does say, I'm innocent of what they're accusing me of. And so that's why he keeps coming back to it. Don? Absolutely.
You know, because you don't know everything.
No.
You don't know the situation. You don't know a lot of things. So, you know, be careful.
And we also have to be careful that things don't always fit our paradigm. We need to sometimes think a little bit, you know, because maybe what you're thinking is right and wrong. Maybe you need to restudy it, you know. So something we always need to be careful of as a Christian. Thank you so much for your comments. Next week, we're going to pick up with chapters 22, 23, and 24. That's Eliphaz. This starts round 3, the third cycle of discussion. So we are definitely making great progress. Thank you very much for your comments, and we'll see you next week.